Now, I know I wasn't the only one who thought this, but Lee Kuan Yew, for example, also thought this. Why was it when the Americans had defeated Saddam's army, why didn't they impose martial law in Baghdad? And Lee Kuan Yew said he couldn't work it out. I think the answer is that if you like, in American psychology or American political culture or what have you, Americans are not imperialists. Americans are certainly not going to follow the practice of the British or the French in dealing with the less developed countries. So they didn't learn from the French in Vietnam. They didn't learn from any of the Europeans regarding Baghdad and Iraq. That famous philosopher Rumsfeld said, "Stuff happens." And indeed, stuff continues to happen. But the trouble is that this does cost. There's an institute at Brown University called Watson's Institute. And they, amongst their various branches, they try to examine the costs of American wars. And according to them, the costs of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which includes also looking after veterans, has come to $6 trillion. This was the figure that I got in 2018. And no wonder when Obama decided in the end that he should pivot to East Asia, there wasn't any money. There wasn't money for the ships, and indeed the production of weapons had gone down. He got some Marines in the north of Australia, in Darwin, but that didn't really seem to change anything very much in the areas in dispute. The Japanese did not believe his assurances about the island in dispute with China, and then he it was only when he went to Japan himself and said that the disputed islands fall under the treaty, the defense treaty that Japan has with the United States, that degree of calmness took over. But even then, the Japanese went 100% convinced. And if you look at what's happened in Japan since then, that under Prime Minister Abe, they have been strengthening their military. And their military now ranks as one of the top militaries in the world. Meanwhile, the effect of globalization, which may have been okay in Asia, was not okay in the developed world. And that partly had to do with the second Bush administration, which A, fought the war by borrowing money, not by raising taxes. On the contrary, they reduced taxes. And secondly, they decided that the financial world could run itself. You didn't need regulation. So you then had the prime mortgages, and you had all of that, and eventually the greatest recession that occurred in 2008. The Chinese, and at that time it was Hu Jintao, thought here was their opportunity. It was at that time they declared that they were a maritime power and began to develop that. Sorry, I'll just say a few words about Taiwan. Taiwan looked at from America, from Washington, is seen primarily as a marvel of democracy. But in Japan, it's regarded as a key strategic element, in determining the extent to which the Chinese can go into the Pacific. There's the Japan Islands, including Okinawa, there's Taiwan, and there's the Philippines. And there are, of course, international straits that allow people to go through in peacetime. But if there were to be armed conflict involving China, those straits could be closed to Chinese military vessels and also to Chinese military air force. And the Chinese know that. I'm sure the Pentagon knows that. But somehow or other, the White House doesn't seem to have taken that in. And in addition to which, of course, the application of the one country, two systems to Hong Kong has confirmed people in Taiwan in their belief, which they've had for a long time, that joining up with China would be extremely damaging to them. Now, if the Chinese approach things differently, one could have thought of a federation or confederation. There could have been all sorts of things. People in Taiwan and people in Beijing can be very inventive when it comes to these matters. But that's not the approach that China takes. And I'll finish on this. In my view, the Chinese regard foreigners as people who have to learn something about China. But the Chinese have no obligation to learn anything about foreigners as long as they show proper deference. And you can see the results of that in the BRI, the Bridge Road Initiative, because the Chinese seem to show no sensitivity to local cultures or to demands for local workers. They don't want contracts to be open. They want to have them guaranteed. They want to have them closed. And they want to deal with just the top people who are open to bribery. And so I don't think there is such a thing as a Chinese international order. Nor do I think there will be one. Nor do I think there'll be a Trumpian one either. Nationalism is all very good, but it doesn't lead to international cooperation. And as we know from Adam Smith onwards, that international economies make an enormous difference to the standard of living of everyone. So that I think we'll end up with perhaps a lesser version of what we had before, but I'll stop now.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Michael, for a wide-ranging discussion. Before I throw it open to the floor, just a couple of points. If you have a question, please just raise your hand and identify yourself before it's asked. One thing I noted, which just kind of made my head spin a little bit to remind us where we are, is in passing you mentioned 2013 and said back in those days. And as a historian, it just made me remember how much the world has changed in such a short time. So I open the floor to questions. Bob.
Bob Sutter from the Elliott School of the George Washington University. Michael, I want to, first of all, I had the advantage of, I've already read the book. I bought the book a long time ago and I read it carefully. It's an excellent book and I use it in my course dealing with the United States and Asia this fall to great effect. And so In the book, and in your remarks too, you talked about the decline of the United States. And clearly it was a theme that you touched on in your remarks as well. And Barack Obama was weak, and was seen as weak in this period. And what we've seen with Donald Trump, now, this is what I'm wrestling with. Clearly, Mr. Trump doesn't seem to have he has a strategy as an administration, but he doesn't follow it, and he doesn't seem to be part of it. So that could be a sense of weakness. But what he has done in the application of power is quite remarkable. Mr. Obama would always compartmentalize and never link an issue. He'd always say, well, the South China Sea would be dealt with by the Defense Department in the South China Sea. It would not be linked to trade. It would not be linked to Taiwan. It would not be linked to anything else. It was South China Sea. And he was very deliberative and transparent. And Mr. Trump isn't, and unpredictable. And he can use all sorts of levers of power that I didn't even realize the U.S. had, which you see this in the economic realm. You see it in investment. You see it in cutting off the supplies. You see it in sting operations, taking PRC operatives in Belgium and getting them extradited to the United States, as sanctioning leaders and so forth. It's quite remarkable to watch. And so I said, well, is that decline? In other words, if I were China, looking at the United States as a competitor, I would say Obama was a lot easier to deal with. The U.S. was weak in that sense. This guy is very hard to deal with. The U.S. is very powerful. That's what I'm wrestling with, that sort of seeming contradiction that, yes, all these elements of decline are everything that you said, but nonetheless, with a leader like Trump, whether you like it or not, he can really apply power in a way that shows how powerful the United States can be.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the writings of Joseph Nye, and he has always maintained that the United States is more powerful than most people recognize. What is the nature of the power? Well, first of all, the United States has enormous resources. Secondly, it only has two neighbors, Canada and Mexico, and then there are the two oceans. So that explains why the shock of 9/11 was so great and is still resonating to a certain extent. In addition to which, America is extraordinarily innovative. The bad side to it is that the Americans, top Americans, if you like, in my view, don't pay enough attention to history. American social science is based on models, and computer models, preferably. I can no longer understand what people who call themselves political scientists write. In my view, history matters enormously. And the history of the United States has been, first of all, migration. Not even Trump can stop it. So that the Einsteins of this world gravitate to the United States. With all the claims made on behalf of China and the number of engineers it has, the number of scientists, the number of science institutions. I haven't heard of people using cyber weapons to steal intellectual property from China. Maybe it is happening, and I don't know. Maybe it's my ignorance. But I would have thought if that had been noted, if that had occurred, somebody would have heard something about it. Why is it that the Chinese authorities are so keen to keep to their current model, which includes having access to other people's intellectual property? Then America still has the most powerful military in the world. Now, doesn't mean to say that that although they can reach every corner in the world, they could necessarily win every battle in every part of the world. But if there were to be an overall challenge to American power, I have no doubt that the Americans could use it. Now, the two previous presidents didn't really use American power. Obama was not interested in using it. Bush focused on the Middle East and terror. And if you look at the amount that America has put into terror, the Homeland Security outfit is enormously expensive. And even so, people want to export to America. People want to export to China as well. But the quality of stuff they can sell in America is much higher than in China. So if you are a Japanese who are more or less at the top of the technological chain, they need America. South Korea is near there, also needs America. China's trying to reach there, it needs America. India wants to have trade with America, because through that you'll get higher technology and so on. So in any respect that you care to think of, everybody wants to deal with America. The most important embassy in any country is the American one. And it's not because necessarily people like Americans, although on the whole they do, but America has soft power. What does China do? China punishes. Says, if you do this, we'll do that. Now, America doesn't, on the whole, doesn't do that. Mr. Trump does it, but on the whole, Americans don't do that. So, it's no surprise to me that America is powerful, and I hope that once Trump does leave, he won't have undermined that power.
Do you mind if I collect a couple of questions?
Is that all right? No.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'm going to collect three questions, so I'll start back there, miss. Yes. Yes.
Okay. Great to see you, Dr. Yakuta. I'm Riho Aizawa, a graduate student at the Elliott School. And as a Japanese means America, I have a question about U.S. direction in the Asia Pacific war. So I felt that during the talk, your talk, we tend to forget international laws, international norms, international organizations are just trials or efforts to stabilize the world. In the era that you mentioned, there is a challenger, such as China, against international laws and international organization. In that era, I believe each country's diplomatic, military, and economical strength and U.S. alliance system will be the core of the security in the region for us. But simply speaking, China has also been trying to split the U.S. alliance system in the region, mainly by conducting political warfare, as currently said. It said, for me, it seems that some of the U.S. alliances are so shady, relatively lean to the Chinese side, such as Philippines, Thailand, and currently South Korea, some people believe. So in that context, not so powerful international norms, laws, international organizations, and some ambiguous allies in the region, what is the best measure for the United States there for its interests?
Thank you. Deepa?
Deepa Lovely from Seeger Center. Thank you for that tour de force, Michael. My question is on, you ended up by saying that there will be no Chinese global order. But let me just shift it to say, what we're talking about Asian politics, what about a Chinese dominant system in Asia? What about Chinese dominance? And I say that because, just to go back to a historian, Paul Kennedy, who said that the basis for the rise of nations has been economic. And when you look whether these countries that you mentioned like BRI or not, they're taking the money. There's no other option right now. And the United States is not actually coming up with lots of infrastructure investment, which is the key need there. And so you also mentioned that, you know, U.S. didn't have money for the pivot. Exactly what Paul Kennedy said, that the decline of nations is due to military overstretch. It seems to me that we can kind of see some, you know, a future that is a little different from what you sketched out. And my a small other question is, Asian international politics in the 20th century, I have to ask you, what is the reason or logic for leaving India out? Thank you.
And quickly in the back there, sir.
Do you think that Chinese have any wish or desire to create an Asian dominant order where they are the leading power? If you think that is true, then what are going to be the features of that order? Because you have that Belt and Road Initiative, and when I was reading the long-term plan for Pakistan, it mostly did with agriculture and tourism, that they wanted Pakistan to be a base for tourists from their citizens and Pakistani agriculture to sort of go towards China so that they it could meet its agricultural needs. So do you think Chinese have wish to have that order?
So two questions about a China-dominant Asia order and a third question about the U.S. In rather shaky waters.
Well, given the constraints of time, I was unable to make the point that since the end of the Cold War, we've had a looser international structure. And the Cold War meant that if you weren't on one side, you were usually on the other. Since then, we've seen the Philippines sort of stick its fingers up against the United States. We've seen North Korea do similar things to China. And I could go on. So there's clearly bound to affect alliances, especially of the United States. But if you think in terms of Japan and Korea, until they develop their own nuclear weapons, they're dependent on American extended deterrence. But their interests may overlap with the United States, but they are not identical to the United States. South Korea clearly has an interest in Korean unification at some point, that the Koreans are belong to the same ethnicity, have the same history, although their cultures and political cultures now are very, very different. But they also know that that China is a powerful neighbor, and that China will play a role if there is to be Korean unification. If the Chinese are against it, it won't happen. It doesn't necessarily mean if the Chinese are for it that it would, but clearly the Chinese have a huge say in the future of Korea. But Koreans fought against China in the early 1950s. And in addition to which, China in the past has sought to exert influence over Korea. And so the South Koreans would want to have their own relationship with China. To a certain extent, applies to Russia too.